Welcome back, folks. It's your pal Cam, and here I am with Sean from Cheap Seat Reviews. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
We were just like, hey, you know, we've done all kinds of topics. We all had these, and everyone's schedule is crazy. And I was like, well, you know, regardless of who's on what episode, I promise to do some kind of version of that topic with that person. Here we are. We are ranking the top fight scenes of the Jason Bourne and Treadstone saga.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. Let's be looking forward to this.
Because it's pretty easy for us to rank, you know, an installment or the best part of a movie. But when you're actually having to get more technical and you're talking, hey, you know, that these are the best moments. It's just like with a comedy, it's like, this is the funniest part of the movie because of this and this character's shocking reveal and what have you, or a horror movie. Like, this movie moment is perfect because of the how it's scored, how it's shot. You know, and with action scenes, it's more subjective because it is, you want to talk visual medium, you really, how it is staged, you know, means so much because action is not ever scripted. It's often less, you know, one sentence of so-and-so punches someone five times, you know, and often that's how it reads. So when you can actually see a fight choreographer take it away and leave a giant impression, you know, you left your mark.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, what was your intro to the Bourne Identity Saga before we get a little deeper into this?
Well, it was funny. So the first Bourne movie came out. Ooh, gosh, I can't remember now. I'm looking it up. Long enough that I was still, I think either living with my parents or I was in college. I think I had to be in college. Yeah. 2002. So yeah, I was in college and I remember coming home, one weekend, from college and, my parents were like, hey, have you seen this thing called the Bourne Identity? I said, no.
Oh.
And they said, you need to check this thing out. I'm like, okay. And so we watched it that night and I was like, oh, this is great. This was a lot of fun. This was a cool action movie. So
a post-Matrix, my parents, Nikita type.
Yeah. So my parents introduced me to it, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I was really blown away by it because there just been so many other things. There were too many similar movies like Minority Report and other fugitive type films coming out. So to avoid all the confusion and actually see it with my uncle and father meant a lot, actually, really. And I really like how it actually kind of went. It's just showing, hey, now that his chapter is done, there's all these other agents out there who have been, some of them have been around since the 70s, you know, Cold War era. Some of them are still kicking ass. And when we get to these fight scenes, they're also great because the villains are just, you know, it seemed like for a while, if you had to be a villain, you had to be in like some Rambo or Lethal Weapon or Die Hard kind of movie to kind of stand out. You had to do your best, you know, Alan Rickman impression, you know, Sean Bean and Patriot Games. And these villains are just great because regardless of how much we actually see them in action, they leave this giant impression, you know, when they walk in the room. Like the professor in the first one is great because, again, that's his, not only his code name, that's what he works like at, you know, during the daytime, and he has a sniper rifle. Part two, you have Carl Urban, you know, years after Lord of the Rings and before Star Trek, and he's just great as this assassin who takes great pride. He gets off on killing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to the third one, and that's where it's really unpredictable. Is like you have like two main assassins there, one played by martial artist Joey Ansah, the other played by Edgar Ramirez, and you know, they're both utilizing a mixture of bombs and snipers rifles, but also go to the next mile where they have to, you know, they can do close quarters combat if they need to, but they often will do gunplay and a lot of taunting, so to speak. Who's your favorite villain of these guys? I mean, I there was the guy who he has the paper, you know, Matt rolled up magazine knife fight with in Supremacy, Jorda, played in Mark and Soka, so you might have seen in The Equalizer and XXX.
Yeah, he's a great villain. Whenever you need generic Eastern European type, you know, villain guy. Yeah, his was good. I'm trying to think of the actual villains that I like the best. I mean, you know, Clive Owen in the first one is kind of interesting.
The professor, because, he was great. And even you actually believe he's intimidating until his final moment on screen. And he's like, he's been bested in a shotgun fight, but he doesn't feel wimpy or anything. He's like, oh, this is the end of my programming.
Well, he also kind of, his end is actually kind of sad because he's like, okay, now I can finally get rid of these headaches or whatever. Like he can finally rest because
yes,
it feels like he doesn't want to do this type of stuff, even though all of these guys, you know, are required to.
Who's going to take care of my kid? Who's going to take care of it? I had no problem killing a dog off screen, but I got a problem with dying now. And even the assassin in the first movie, how he just busts open through that window, is like he gets shanked in, you know, with like a pin.
Yeah, the pin fight scene is pretty iconic. I mean, that's kind of the first time we see what this movie is going to be, and from that point on, like it just doesn't disappoint.
Yeah. Who would have guessed? You know, it's so atypical of a typical fight. The last time we saw something crazy like that might have been District B-13 2 years later, maybe even something else like The Transporter from the same year or Leon the Professional. Just having that French New Wave kind of a stylish cinema without insulting the audience or making them feel like it's a over-the-top music video. It's just so well put together, like you say, and it helps that a lot of these guys, much like the guy at the beginning of Casino Royale, is like they have a gymnastic kind of background or athletic momentum. And I mean, Kirill, who I mentioned with Carl Urban in part two, you know, he already has the bad guy cards just ratcheted up because, again, he snipes Bourne's girlfriend. So you love to hate him, but he never stops being imposing, whether he's in a car or whether he's on foot, you know, being followed. Or whether he's doing the following, he's good at being unpredictable, and so for me, he just definitely ranks just so high, just as one of the various assassins. he even gets, I think, shot at like in the shoulder briefly, and no, he shoots at Bourne, I think, in the shoulder, and Bourne's having to process the pain and fake his death before going after him.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
I was even actually surprised in Legacy how there's that in motorcycle chase.
Well, every movie, so the three main movies, the original trilogy, and then we had, you know, then we have the Jeremy Renner one, and then the fourth with Matt Damon. So I'm talking about in the original trilogy, they all kind of have the same formula, right? He has to fight two to three
endless
other guys, right? Mm-hmm. While also evading police. There's going to be some kind of either foot chase and or vehicle chase. There's got to be some kind of vehicle chase. So in the first one, we had that great Mini Cooper scene, right? Which we're coming off of the heels of the Italian Job.
Oh, yeah. And yes.
We're with, you know, all those other Mini Coopers. And so, like,
is going off the road onto a train track.
we were in Mini Cooper heaven in this point. So,
oh, yeah. I wanted one for the longest time. Fun fact.
Oh, I did too. I test drove one. I mean,
did you really?
Yeah. I'm 6 feet tall, and I got in this that Mini Cooper, and I thought I could ride in it. The only reason why I didn't is because my son at the time was an infant. So that would have meant that I would have to pull down the seat and kind of reach in behind to lock in, you know, the car seat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas now both of them are old enough that they could climb in, but I've moved past that point of my life where I want a Mini Cooper.
I am too. It's just growing up, that and the Dodge Charger from Blade were my favorite. And it is kind of cool how, again, it's kind of a semi sci-fi thing, outing, if you will.
Yeah.
It's because of the programming and just again, these people who know they're doing unethical things, and yet, you know, they're going to keep getting away with it until it's finally shut down. It's also, like you say, very cool how it's just all the fights are dynamite and move the story forward. And we hadn't kind of seen anything really like that in a while, aside from, say, something like maybe Terminator 2, maybe the first Matrix. You know, it's just see these movies kind of still kind of be the kings of, you know, action affects everybody and moves it forward. You can't not have it because it's all part of the scenario, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just so frustrating when you see a movie nowadays and it feels like a Lethal Weapon kind of knockoff, when you're just like, yeah, but if I take it out, nothing really changes.
Well, the one thing that I really have always liked about these fight scenes, because for the most part, Jason is using Matt Damon's character, Jason Bourne, is using some kind of prop. And
yeah, he uses everything. Everything is a weapon. Everything is MacGyver.
Well, what I love about that is, so I'm a big fan of the Jackie Chan movies. I love all these Jackie Chan movies. So Jackie Chan was kind of the pioneer when it comes to prop fighting, right? He'll beat you up with a broomstick or a ladder or scaffolding or whatever, just whatever he can get his hands on. And so when Matt Damon does it, now it's smaller, right? It's a rolled up newspaper. It's a book. It's a pen.
It's so calculated. And like you say, because when Jackie Chan started out, everyone, you know, was saying, oh, he's the next Buster Keaton or Three Stooges type, you know, humor. But it's like, well, now that he's just the humor, he's doing some serious stuff or action stuff. Now, again, yes, the environment is his weapon, and he's going to do everything from jumping up the side of a door and then ripping it off and hitting you with it, or sliding down. And he just finds the simplest, most harmless object and makes it harmful.
Yeah, exactly.
These villains are going for the obvious, like a kitchen knife or a fork, or, you know, throwing a broken plate, you know, at any of these spies in this movie and even the short-lived Treadstone show. And all the agents are calculated to literally kind of like a human Terminator. Just like assess, they know everything that's in the room before we see it. We, the audience, see it, so we don't feel cheated or like it was just a random plot hole or something we're missing. And it's just so wild how, again, yeah, like even in that initial fight with that other guy that we described at the beginning, when he's suffocating him, he's literally using the guy's own garroting wire against him, having to ice his hands afterwards. And just like, he's so used to, again, having his hands bruised, but he rehabilitates them, and that makes it all the more human. You're just like, okay, that's totally what any of us would be doing, but we would be aching for days. But, you know, he can subdue the pain, but he still has to address the muscle, you know, fractures and bruises that are otherwise going to become his problem again down the road if he doesn't deal with it now.
Yeah. Well, you've got to, you know, he's a superhero. He's got to find a way to, you know, Mr. Miyagi, the pain away.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good way of putting it. And I really am bummed that Aaron Cross and Bourne didn't get their own movie together. I really thought they could have been fun having to force to hunt each other or something like that. Oh,
are those part of the same universe? I don't know the Aaron Cross series.
Aaron Cross is Renner's character in Legacy.
Oh, Aaron Cross. Yeah, you said that. I was thinking, what was that Aaron? It was another something movie that had
Renner as a spy.
No, not him. No. My brain is totally fried. It's a Tuesday. What was his name? My gosh.
Matt Damon. Big,
I'm going to look this up. This is going to drive me crazy. No, you're not wrong. The Jeremy Renner Cross, yeah, that would have been cool. They were supposed to do that. They were supposed to. That there was going to be a sixth movie where and the two just of them
having Rachel Weisz as that cool heroine, and she's having to drive the motorcycle while Aaron is having to fight the one assassin, Lark's number three, and Legacy on that end motorcycle chase. I was digging it because I already knew that actor from Predators, and he's gone on to be in a bunch of movies and shows, including Bosch and even Supergirl of all movies and shows, but I was like, this guy needs more roles. He is my go-to Owl Yong.
Right.
He is my go-to henchman, and he's been in some other stuff too, like Man in the High Castle and Spectral and Mysteries of Laura. So, pretty cool guy.
Yeah.
But did you ever see any of the Treadstone show?
No, I didn't. I completely missed it. I honestly don't even remember.
Everyone thought it was wrongfully like canceled, and it's satisfying enough, but like it's so merited. Like the cast was dynamite, some semi-known actors that you've seen in all sorts of things and newcomers, and it just handled the flashbacks so well. And I knew it was going to be so complex, so I didn't make the mistake of what most people do, which is a week-by-week basis. I'm like, no. I knew within minutes this is going to be like Bosch or The Expanse. You have to watch 3 episodes a night if you want anything to be retained in your memory, you know?
Yeah.
We'll return after these messages.
Hello and welcome to Culture Shocked, the pop culture podcast brought to you by 4 aging millennials and our outdated opinions. Join us every Tuesday as we discuss movies, TV, games, and even music, new and old.
Dude, what do you think you're doing?
Are you seriously trying to record a promo without us right now?
Well, yeah.
Dude, you can't just do the promo by yourself. Who's gonna listen to that?
Yeah, and you probably haven't even told them that we're a pop culture podcast where we always agree on everything. For instance, the Sam Raimi trilogy easily being the best of the Spider-Man movies.
No. But I think we can all agree that Jaws is a classical masterpiece.
Nope, don't like that. But we do all agree that the sequel trilogy of Star Wars is the best in the Skywalker saga, right, guys?
That comment is so ridiculous. I don't even know where to
Anyways, that'll do it from all of us here at Culture Shock. Thanks for listening.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US, we are in the UK, we are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
There's going to be little clues that, like, in the last minute, that's going to be a big part of the mystery. And it does pay off because, you know, again, the action moves it forward. It doesn't get over complex or where you're like, well, that's all redundant information. That was too much info. I didn't need to know that. It's like, no, it's pretty much, it all leads to, okay, it does a good job of reminding you, okay, now we're in the 70s. Now we're back in the present day. And I kept even guffawing because there was this one good actor in it who looked like a doppelganger, a Robert Downey Jr. And so at first I was even asking my sister, I'm like, is Iron Man supposed to be in this? Right. That'd be a cool crossover, but that's not the case. But good actor, but he looks so much like Robert Downey Jr.
So what I was trying to say was, the actor I was trying to think of was Tyler Perry, who played Alex Cross.
The James Patterson adaptation. Yeah.
That's where I was really confused. Like, I don't think Robert Ludlum and James Patterson had a crossover thing going on.
No. Alex Cross in the books is basically an urban James Bond as a detective. That's it. Oh, that'd be funny though.
Right. Did you read any of the Bourne series, the books?
I did try reading, I think, one of them, and Frederick Forsyth, they're very hard to get into. You got to realize the time in which it was made is like, okay, you know, we didn't have movies and TV that were fast paced back then. And I did find it interesting how in those he's a Vietnam veteran, you know,
right.
He's a Navy SEAL practically. And, you know, here they had to change it to where it's like kind of post Gulf War, just kind of active duty. And I like how they showed that flashback with Aaron Cross, how he's like on like a Kosovo or European mission doing some private security overseas. And it's like, yeah, that's awesome. But I do like how they've even tried continuing it. And I know one of the newer books definitely got some heated takes because it kind of went too crazy sci-fi. Like there was a scientist using like some robotic science and you're like, whoa, whoa, this is too much. It's James Bond, not Jason Bourne.
Interesting. Yeah. I read about three of them. I can't remember which ones.
They really do all kind of go together after a while.
They do. So the one that I remember the most was, it wasn't the first one. It wasn't the Bourne Identity, but it was like the second or third one. And that's when you realize that the movies are nothing with the book at all.
No.
So like Chris Cooper's character, Conklin, they're in the book, they're buddies, they're friends. They're like best friends. And Jason Bourne was a character that was a creation by the character. We find out his real name.
David Webb.
David Webb, right.
Yeah.
Like David Webb, you know, he has this David Webb is his real name, and then he goes to Vietnam and does some horrific things in the name of God and country and decides, I don't want to be that person anymore. So that's where he creates the Jason Bourne character. Mm. And so the book that I read was somebody is trying to kill him and Treadstone. And they find out that it's this famed The Jackal character.
Tell no one.
Right. And so he has to like go on this European kind of spy thing to figure out who this guy is. And it turns out that it was somebody that knew him from his Vietnam days who's trying to get revenge on the stuff that he did back then. So it was a neat book. There's another one I read, but I don't remember. This was back, I mean, this is legit, probably close to 20 years ago when I did a lot of driving. And so I did a lot of audiobooks. I probably consumed two audiobooks.
It's great, isn't it? Saves time.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you're driving 6 hours at a time, you can consume half a book in one trip, basically.
I'm the same way. I used to have a movie going or a show going on Netflix, and then I got too distracting. So then I just switched to podcasts and music again.
Yeah.
It's like you don't feel alone. You feel so spirited, and that's way better than just, you know, bullshitting around on Facebook, you know, for 20 minutes and then boredom the rest of the time. It's, you got to have that just some kind of entertainment going while you're working, while you're driving. And it is kind of cool how everyone's rediscovering that now, especially when they've had to be alone post pandemic. And, you know, it's just, entertainment doesn't go away, but there has to be some kind of soul to it. And I like how we do it for these podcasts, you know, it's like, hey, let's review this again, but we need a refresher or we need to do some extra research on this if we've seen the movie many times.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there's still, I would not be surprised if there's more interest in doing Bourne again. I hope they don't remake any of these movies, especially how recent the show was. Is like, they should, if anything, do an audio book series, maybe, or maybe a spoof.
Well, I mean this, it's a property that's got some name recognition, like a James Bond or I guess really James Bond's the only thing that can come to mind. But if they ever were to remake it, I don't think that they shouldn't. I mean, I don't see why not. I mean, obviously Matt Damon is too old to play it, or you can
just give it 30 years is all I ask, you know.
Well, you can wait long enough, wait a few more years, and then let because they ended the fifth movie, yeah, on a cliffhanger. So I think they want to do at least one more. I really do think that. And it would be kind of neat if they introduce a third character who can kind of, maybe that person kind of has to take the mantle of Jason Bourne, and then that person can have, you know, a series of movies or whatever. So, you know, like get some young, you know, young buck to go around doing action stuff. I don't know who, but not, you know, like Tom Holland, but not Tom Holland, you know, he's in everything. Yeah. Right now, but
no, I know what you mean. That would be good, because then, you know, it's just like any of these sci-fi adaptations. It's like, if there might be a famous, well-known version of it, but let's do a different version of it then at this point. So that's perfect. Yeah. I think you're onto something, and that could definitely be something that occurs down the road.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to see if I can find anything that would suggest that that's happening. I don't see anything on IMDb, but
Universal probably kept it. Wait, five Comic Cons down the road, probably. Oh, awesome.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
So I guess we could kind of split this up here and then start talking Mission Impossible if you want.
Well, the last thing I want to say about the Jason Bourne films is, let's see, hold on. I found an article, but it's super old, so I'm not going to, it's not even worth reading. I mean, this thing, it's so old.
We're talking
but like it did say, that well, it's 2016.
Yeah.
But Bourne 6th will expand the Jason Bourne universe. But I mean, that was... Producer Frank Marshall says that he wants to blah, 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 blah. So anyway, who knows? That's so old news. I'm not going to even worry about it. But the last thing I'll say about the thing. So I do actually want to ask you this. So of the five Bourne films that we have, I want to ask you which one is your favorite and why. And then I do want to ask you something else. Because we were talking about our favorite fight scenes, but if you have like a favorite just moment or scene, or even if it's a fight scene or not, but of all of them, my favorite is still the first one. I love the first one.
For the longest time, I disputed it. It started out with part two, then I became a big fan of part three, and I really started appreciating one and its slower moments, especially with how, you know, he becomes friends with Marie and then romantic partners, and then just all the utter suspense of the various guys and how some of them end up reappearing in part two. But part three for me is definitely when Pamela Landy is knowingly used as a distraction so Bourne can get into her office while the other guys are out and about chasing him. They're like, how do you get in here?
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
What are you
cool.
doing here?
That was
go out and find him again. And then you're followed by it's a New York type city. Next thing you know, it's followed by a bunch of police cars going after him, and he has to wreck some of those cars, you know. And then the agents are going after him, and then they're killing some of the cops so they don't see anything. It's so crazy. Oh man. But yeah, there's so many good moments, and cats off to the dialogue by Tony Gilroy and bringing his pals in here. And it says a lot for a movie that was supposedly doomed at first. Like, it kept getting behind schedule. They fired director Doug Liman, and then Matt Damon went the extra mile to get in shape, and then actually learned some different languages, and then just with the right kind of editing and retooling and reshoots, they pulled off a surprise hit, you know, in spring of all places of 2002. You know, it's just a phenomenon, and I don't understand why people have problems with the fights or find them too shaky. I have zero problems watching these. I don't get dizzy or anything like I do with, say, maybe Dark Knight Rises, or maybe a lesser sci-fi epic where everything is needlessly shaking. I really like, again, the on-foot chases. I like some surprisingly amusing moments where everyone's like, oh, he's coming for you. Just that. I like how even Tommy Lee Jones was playing a different character than what we're used to seeing in every other fugitive inspired movie he was doing back in the day. I like just how this world went and it kept taking risks. I'm with you. I think it's dynamite.
Okay. Yeah. Right on. The last thing I'll say is this, is that one of my favorite moments in the series is in the third one, the third Bourne movie, where he's trying to save the blonde girl, not Marie, but
Julia Stiles' character.
Julia Stiles, that's her. Running on these rooftops, right? And
not Nikki Parsons, is it?
I don't care, it doesn't matter to me. But yeah, Julia Stiles.
Now I want to know. I used to have all their names memorized.
And so there's this really great scene where he's running and he's jumping over like the different roofs. And I thought it was really, really clever where he grabs a cloth, right? And he wraps it around his hand. So when he jumps over, because there's like pieces of glass to keep people from doing what he's doing. And he's like, he's again, using his environment to his advantage. And, right? And I watched the behind the scenes, how they shot this thing, right? And they had this huge zip line where they, you know, had this camera going so they can get this really great tracking shot showing Matt Damon running and jumping.
Yes. Oh my God.
Absolutely. But then the coolest part is the scene where the stunt double, right? It's not Matt Damon, but the stunt double has to jump off the roof and land into the window of the apartment building next to it. And there's about a 10-foot jump or gap.
Hats off to Dan Bradley. He did a lot of the second unit directing and stunt coordinating. He since has worked on other giant franchises like The Expendables, Dark Knight, James Bond films, and there's a great stunt book. I think it's like The Full Burn or something like that. And he's outlines how this was the most rewarding of his whole career because he'd done so many other movies like the year before. Like Swordfish was known, but it was kind of more of an infamous movie. And then he did Cradle to the Grave, and all the expensive helicopter stunts barely last even 3 minutes on screen despite all the work. And he loved this because this was during the car chases. I don't know if you know this, they used multiple cameras. They show even barely a segment on it on the Part Freeze DVD special features, but like he loved this because he got to show a lot of the cramped what it's like driving these smaller cars in peril and get an emotional reaction out of the audience, play on that more while also introducing various stunts. And hats off to him because the various foot chase, I think they're in Madrid at that point. And then, following the, Borden gets up almost having been killed by the motorcycle bombing. And then, he's having to chase after the assassin and stop him from killing Nikki. And just he bursts through that window just off the roof. And you're just like, whoa, how did they accomplish that? Even though they told us how, I just really, seriously, how? You don't get too many different takes without that much practice and measuring and, rehearsal.
Well, the scene that was really fun about it was that so the director is telling the camera operator, this is what's going to happen. And the camera operator says, I'm not doing that. I'm not jumping off the thing. Yes. And so one of the other stunt guys was like, well, I'll do it. They just show me what to do. So they literally put him in a harness and they attached the camera to the harness and to him to a zip line. So when the stunt guy jumps, he jumps with him, right?
Yeah.
And so he jumps out, and that's why the camera guy doesn't go into the window, because he goes just a little bit short. But that was
they got their money's worth. That's what mattered. No one got killed, so that was good too.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a cool stunt. It was obviously done very safe, but it's just a really cool way to do it.
Yeah, I haven't seen as much of that nowadays. The closest I've probably has been maybe with a few shots with maybe the Equalizer 2, and definitely some of the John Wicks have been pretty ballsy with how they display knife fights and close quarter type shootouts. And it's just so cool to see this amount of, again, just carnage that you're invested in. You still want to see these characters who are seemingly invincible, but who can still bleed and get out of these situations. And this was just a good compromise to just show that PG-13 action didn't have to suck, didn't have to be just another straightforward cop or Western movie. It could be a cool spy movie other than James Bond, which James Bond is cool, but this is a different kind of spy. And we had a bunch of spies on cable TV, like The Americans and 24, but this was just a cool counterpart. It's like, hey, and I mean, I look at some of the other actors and they definitely got a bunch of other roles that were just clearly they would have never gotten had they not been in the Bourne films.
yeah. Well, I mean, this was, the second movie is when those, one of the first times we see Carl Urban, but he did make his appearance in Lord of the Rings before.
Yeah, before that and Riddick was the same year. And this role just stood out so much to me because he just had so much to work with, even though his character's only really seen at one nightclub. You just understand that, again, he has no remorse for what he does. He enjoys it quite a lot. And I like how he just starts up the whole cat and mouse. It's kind of he considers it a rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to, again, you know, and he wants to take down Bourne if he's going to go there. And then Bourne's having to get away through cars and then find a way to beat him at his game. But yeah, this was a dynamite chat, sir. It was great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.